something happening here, but what it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there, telling me I got to beware. I think it's time we stop, children, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.
Welcome to a very special Montana Public Radio Sunday night special. I'm Alan Setcher.
And I'm Bo Baker.
During the summer, I was introduced to Navy Commander Denny Moore of San Diego, California, by his sister, Phyllis Quatman of Whitefish. Commander Moore's plane was shot down over Vietnam in 1965, and he spent 7.5 years as a prisoner of war in 8 Vietnamese prisons, including the infamous Hanoi Hilton.
American involvement in Vietnam started more than 60 years ago, when President Eisenhower began funding French war efforts to stop communism in Southeast Asia. North Vietnamese communist forces led by Ho Chi Minh defeated the French and mobilized to take control of the country. By the time President Kennedy took office, the U.S. was ratcheting up its military presence, trying in vain to support the unpopular Diem regime in South Vietnam. In late 1963, Diem and his close allies were ousted. This event signaled trouble for South Vietnam and the U.S. war effort. From this moment on, an American presence in the conflict was certain. Commander Moore became one of more than 500 POWs in North Vietnamese prison camps.
Denny Moore has kept his story very private until this very moment. Why have you never told your story?
I don't think I wanted to. The experience was unpleasant enough that I did not want to remember it. A lot of people have completely different reactions to a bad situation, but my own personal view was that I did not want to remember it. It was over and done with. Not, and then that's sort of selfish because apparently people can gain something from listening to my tale about my experience as a prisoner of war in Vietnam, and it could be beneficial.
When the Vietnam War starts, you're on a carrier. Where are you?
Well, I think we can say the war started on the 4th of August, 1964. That was when the first air raids were made against North Vietnam targets, and that was the day that the first POW was shot down, Ev Alvarez. Now, you can argue that it started well before that because there were ground forces in Vietnam well before that period, but there was an incident, supposedly with the North Vietnamese naval forces and U.S. naval forces in the Gulf of Tonkin. It was called the Gulf of Tonkin Incident. And our response to that was to conduct these airstrikes on North Vietnam. We were in the area, but we did not participate in the actual attack on North Vietnam. Our carrier was down south. So that's where I was. I was in Fighter Squadron 191 on board the USS Bonhomme Richard in the South Pacific.
How much were you told at this period of time of what you were fighting for?
I think in general we were told that the fight was necessary to stop the domino effect. The domino effect was that if South Vietnam fell to the communist regime in North Vietnam, then that would trigger a fall in the government of Cambodia, of Laos, perhaps Thailand, perhaps Burma, perhaps Indonesia, perhaps the Philippines. In other words, the communist plague would envelop all of Southeast Asia.
So you were fighting communism, in short.
This is 1964, the 1960s. Yeah, communism was a big evil thing in those days.
It's now on your 66th combat mission.
Roughly, yeah.
Will you take me back to that moment, please?
This day was the 27th of October, 1965. We were briefed to accompany some different aircraft. We were flying fighters. We were going to accompany a couple of attack airplanes, A-4s, to a target in Laos. We were going to stay high, and they were going to go in low, do their thing, and then we would join up with them again and escort them back to the carrier. Because we stayed high, we were in the jet stream, and the jet stream was blowing probably a couple hundred miles an hour toward the east. If you have a mental picture, Laos is to the west of Vietnam. So we were blown into Vietnam territory, and we had no nav aids to tell us that was happening to us. So the next thing I knew, there was a surface-to-air missile came up between myself and my wingman, who was about a mile away from me or a half a mile away from me. And then the next thing that happened was one of those missiles hit my aircraft and I think blew the tail off because I immediately lost control and pulled the ejection seat, just sort of instinctively. It went from the rush of wind going past my helmet to total and absolute silence. I'd never experienced silence like that until the chute opened and I was in the middle of a cloud. And I didn't break out of the clouds until about 1,000 feet above the ground. And then all I could see was rice paddies as far as the eye could see. I fell into an irrigation canal that was fairly wide. And I inflated my life preserver to stay afloat because I was weighted down with a lot of gear. And immediately started to hear gunfire. They were shooting over my head, and there was a crowd of people on the bank of this canal motioning me to come over to them. There was no way to fight my way out of that situation. All I had was a .38 revolver that was used for signaling purposes mainly. So didn't have much choice but to swim over to the bank, either that or get shot. So I swam over to the bank, and they dragged me out of the water and then started taking off all of the equipment. And then we walked back to this very small, tiny village through the street, and everybody was out by now. It seemed like maybe 100 people or so. And they were all, it seemed at the time, just very, very curious because it was probably the biggest event that had ever happened in their small village. And they took me to a militia hut on the outskirts of this little village, sat me down on a stool. I wasn't tied up or anything. Gave me a cup of tea. I didn't really realize that I was in Vietnam. That square had not been filled yet. I was in that state that some people find themselves in from time to time where something real is happening, but you think it's a dream or you wish it was a dream. And that's sort of the state of mind I was in for the first hour or two.
In the militia hut, armed guards?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they had them. It was literally a hut with, you know, thatched roof and no real walls or anything. I later found out that the village got a big reward for capturing an American pilot. The next thing that happened was a big Jeep arrived with some military people in it. And so they put me in the back seat of the Jeep, and off we went to a town. I don't know where the town was, but it could have been a town called Sante. They took me there, and it was an official building in the town. They put me in a jail cell with a young Vietnamese guard, and this poor guy seemed very, very nervous and uncomfortable by the fact that he was cooped up with an American pilot in this jail. Stayed there for an hour or so waiting, and then they took me out and into a room that was off of a stage set. It was bare-walled. There was a bare light bulb dangling from the ceiling to light it up. There was a small desk and a chair and a stool. And then behind the desk was a great big portrait of Joseph Stalin. It was almost theatrical in its arrangement. And then probably a Vietnamese intelligence officer walked in and started asking me questions. And I stuck to the code of conduct at the time was name, rank, serial number, and date of birth. And he seemed to go along with that. You know, he would ask questions and say, I can't answer that. I can give you my name, rank, serial number, and date of birth. And so we went back and forth, not for very long, 30 or 40 minutes, and then back in the Jeep. And by then it was dark. I estimate the time of day around 10 o'clock at night or thereabouts. And we headed to, later turned out, Hanoi.
The next stop is Hanoi.
Mm-hmm.
So let's describe that.
Well, I couldn't see much because it was dark, and if I remember right, I was blindfolded in the Jeep. But we got to what turned out to be the Wallo prison or the Hanoi Hilton. They're synonymous. And they took me into the Hanoi Hilton and into a room that I thought was my cell. It was a fairly large room, and it had a big table on it, maybe 6 feet long, with a tablecloth on it. There was a chair and a stool, and I put it all together that this was my cell and to make myself comfortable. So I took the tablecloth off the table and laid down on the table and put the tablecloth over me and tried to get some sleep. And a guard walks in and is just outraged because this is an official interrogation room, and I had just tried to sleep on the table for the intelligence officer. I got a few hits from a rifle butt at that point. And then an interrogation process started at that time that lasted about, I don't know, 4 or 5 days, I guess.
Did the interrogation include beating, torture?
It depends on your definition of torture. The technique that they used a lot was to handcuff your hands behind your back and tighten the handcuffs down so that they hurt, and then put your legs in leg irons, which were just like a stockade at the foot of the bed. So you could not lie down because your hands were behind you. The handcuffs hurt. You could not turn your body very much because your feet were locked in these leg irons at the foot of the bed. Pretty much a constant battle of extreme discomfort, maybe not excruciating pain, but just extreme discomfort over a long period of time. It's sort of like Chinese water torture. You know, the first few drops aren't that bad, but after 1,000 drops, it starts to...
Some of the things that I've been reading talks about beatings in the early days of prisoners. You did mention rifle butts, but were you getting beaten at the same time?
No, not me. Now, there were other guys that had far worse treatment than I did, for sure.
Why them and not you?
It depends on your personal attitude toward your captors. Some people were very hostile toward them. And you have to remember, we're talking about an Asian nation that puts a lot of stock in saving face, not being disrespected, not being insulted, or so forth. So if you behaved in a way that they thought was extremely offensive, they would get really, really angry.
What did they want from you?
What they were really after was propaganda in the form of statements condemning the war, the American policy in Vietnam, the fact that we were even there, we had no business being there, this was a civil war, not a war of conquest by North Vietnam, and therefore America is wrong and should get out of Vietnam.
We gotta get out of this place.
We're at the Hanoi Hilton. It's in your early days. What's next?
Well, after the initial interrogation that lasted about 5 days and was just in and out of handcuffs and leg irons, not much food, and then, as in most cases, you as a prisoner reach a point where this is all I can handle sort of situation, and you start to give them little bits and pieces of information you think will satisfy them, but are either bogus or of little value whatsoever. And that's what the interrogators are looking for, is for you to stop resisting and sort of go along with them. And then not long thereafter, they moved me over to another section in the prison called Heartbreak Hotel. It was just a one-man cell, but that's the place where I learned the tap code. Somebody had inscribed the tap code on the wall of the cell, along with a very simple little instruction on how to use it.
What the heck was tap code?
Well, it was a means of communication. It was a little bit analogous to Morse code, but if you can picture a 5x5 matrix or grid in your mind, and in the upper left-hand corner would be the letter A going all the way across to the letter E, that's 5 across, then going down to the second row and filling in the rest of the alphabet, with the last column being J, and make that JK, so that we wind up, instead of 26 letters, we have 25 letters. And you fill in the rest of the matrix. And then to tap a letter out, you tap first the row number and then the column number. So the common thing that we would tap to start out with is two taps followed by two taps, which is the letter H, and then two taps followed by four taps, which is the letter I.
And this you learned almost immediately upon your capture?
Within a week. You got very fast at tapping out stuff. And then we would anticipate what somebody is starting to spell out. So maybe just the first two letters of a word, and we knew what the word was going to be, and we'd give them an acknowledgement, go to the next word. There were certain occasions at certain camps where people would be let out to do a little cleanup around the buildings, and they would sweep out any news that they might have or any information that they thought was just by sweep, 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 sweep. I mean, the desire to communicate is so powerful, is what I found. And I think everybody who was there could attest to that, that communicating with another person is vital under those circumstances. And you'll go to any extreme to try to get any kind of message through. It doesn't make too much difference what the message is, just that you're communicating.
What did you have as far as personal effects goes?
The clothing we called pajamas, because they were basically like pajamas. It was a long sleeve shirt. It was striped, and I think it was sort of pinkish stripes and black stripes or olive drab. We had a pair of shorts and some trousers. And then as far as implements go, you had a tin cup. Mostly it was to drink, and its primary function was as an amplifier for tapping through walls. You could put the open end of the cup against the wall and then speak, and it would cause the end of the cup to vibrate, transmit through the wall, and then the person on the other side had the same setup. So you could tap very, very softly and still be heard on the other side of the wall. So it was a very useful communication device. And then what else? A straw mat, an aluminum spoon that they claimed was made out of old airplanes, a cotton blanket, a toothbrush, and toothpaste.
That was it.
That was your kit, yeah. And the Vietnamese, for whatever reason, decided to give us two cigarettes a day.
Hmm.
The brand name was Trong Song. They were not the finest tobaccos by any shot, but they were something to look forward to twice a day. They would bring around one in the morning and one in the afternoon. It was an event that was pleasant or enjoyable.
All right, and how about sanitary facilities?
That was the classic bucket. So everything went in the bucket and it was emptied on a daily basis.
How about the ability to wash your hands, take a shower?
That depended on the time and place. Normally, they tried to let you out once a day to go to a separate area that was like a bathhouse. And it was just like big cisterns full of water and a bucket. So you dip the bucket in and pour it over your head. And you had a little bit of soap. I forgot that as part of the kit. They did give us a little bit of soap. There was one period of time when they were trying to get information, a written confession, I think it was. I didn't have a bath for 3 months. And that's my first experience with a beard. And that's why I never wear a beard anymore.
When they let you out, were you then with others or is it one at a time?
I was in solitary for a year and then got my first roommate after a year. So if you had a roommate, both of you went out to the bathhouse. If it was just you, that was just you.
You're in solitary confinement.
Mm-hmm.
What are you doing with yourself in solitary?
Most of the time is spent making plans for the future. It was like, this is something good, and I can plan out what I'm going to do once I get out of here. I mean, it can go in so many different directions depending on the individual. Some people built in their mind their dream boat. Some people built, obviously, their own home. Other people built their, you know, their muscle car in their head. There were lots of things that people constructed in their mind or made plans for, you know, this trip, that trip, vacation here, and so forth. So a lot of time was spent doing that.
What were you doing?
I think I fantasized about cars and maybe starting a family, where I'd like my next duty station, but I don't recall details right now.
And in solitary, how did you keep track of time?
I don't know, but we never lost track of time. We knew what day it was, what day of the week it was, what month it was, and, of course, pretty good approximation of what time of day it was. So keeping track of time never became a problem. It was just seemed like it was automatic.
In those early months, when did you figure you were going to get out?
That almost became a standing joke. It did, actually, amongst us. Because initially, when you're shot down, you think that it's going to be a month or two. And indeed, there were politicians who were saying that the Vietnam War, when I was shot down in October of 65, that the war was not going to last much more than 3 or 4 more months. I think Robert McNamara made such a ridiculous statement at one point in time. So I came in with that little bit of knowledge that, well, this is only going to last 2 or 3 months, and then it'll be over and we'll all go home. And then, of course, as time goes by and that doesn't happen, you keep readjusting. You keep extending your estimate as to how long the war is going to last until I got to a point which was probably after, gosh, the second year, third year maybe, that I don't know when this war is going to last. It may last another year or 2 or 3. Part of the process of being incarcerated is you get institutionalized. And that process for me was to tone down my optimism to almost zero and tone down my pessimism to almost zero. So that basically you were emotionally flatlined and you guarded that state of being as best you could, because we had found out when you got very optimistic, then there was this huge letdown when what you were optimistic about did not come to pass.
Did you ever despair?
Oh, Lord, yes, of course. And that was part of getting low emotionally. I did not like being there. I did not like being depressed. I would rather be neutral than that and skip the optimism part if I could stay at a neutral spot. But there were times when I was just overcome with despair, I guess.
I just finished reading a book about POWs during World War II. And one of the things that was clear is that Americans who were POWs in Germany always had to worry about being killed. Did you?
I don't ever think I worried about being killed, and it was partly just my American ego at work. I'm too valuable as an American prisoner to the Vietnamese. And I think that was pretty much prevalent amongst us. Now, there's got to be exceptions, but nevertheless, I thought that it would be completely irrational for them to do us much in the way of harm, certainly not to kill us, because we were such good bargaining chips. 1967, toward the end of that year, and bombing was going on all around Hanoi, and then in some cases in Hanoi itself. And so from our cell in the Hanoi Hilton, we could hear the bombs go off. And one day some guards came and took myself and another cellmate out, and we got in a truck and they transported us, we later found out, to a very crudely put together, quickly put together facility that was basically some single-story rooms on a street in Hanoi somewhere, very close to the thermal power plant in Hanoi, which is what the U.S. was trying to bomb. And they apparently wanted it known that we were there so that the U.S. wouldn't drop bombs. It was so poorly put together that there were no bars on the windows. They had sort of haphazardly bricked them up. It was just put together very quickly, obviously. Not much in the way of a door. And so there were a couple of guys that actually escaped from there, we found out. They were caught, and one of them did not make it back alive. We don't know what exactly happened to him, but the other guy did, but he suffered terribly as a result. But anyway, my roommate and I were in this one room. We had wooden pallets to sleep on, and that was it, and a bucket. And that was the furnishings. And a bombing raid started. And the bombs seemed to be going off very close by. Also, the AAA, or anti-aircraft artillery, was firing very close by. And they hurl out some very big shells. So when they go off, it's a big, loud sound. And as the bombs dropped and the AAA was firing, the ceiling in this room, which was just a regular civilian building, the plaster all fell off and down on top of our heads. So we got completely coated with plaster dust. At that point, we crawled under these wooden pallets to shield us from more falling plaster. And I don't think I've ever been more scared in my life. That was probably the scariest moment I've ever had in my life, because I was sitting under this board after having the ceiling fall on my head, and all these sounds going off, huge, loud explosions, and the earth shaking, and wondering if the next bomb is going to hit me. It's just an awful feeling. It's just an awful feeling.
And how long were you there?
Only about 2 weeks.
And they stopped bombing, or they continued?
Apparently they stopped. I don't know. As far as I know, they stopped bombing. But another sound that was occurring were people screaming their heads off. Just
so there was
Vietnamese civilians
Vietnamese
screaming.
Vietnamese populace nearby.
Oh, yeah. Screaming their heads off.
There must be some kind of way out of here. Say the Joker to the thief. There's too much confusion. I can't get no